This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Somalia is experiencing a moment of both tragedy and hope. Tragedy because a drought-induced humanitarian crisis is now engulfing the country with imminent risk of famine. Hope because the recent electoral process has created momentum for fresh political engagement among Somalis.
That's UN Special Representative for Somalia, Michael Keating, addressing the Security Council today. Details next.
Also, floods kill at least 11 people and leave thousands homeless in Angola's northwestern Luanda province. And armed groups are preventing thousands of children in the Central African Republic from getting an education.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the UN Security Council was briefed today on the humanitarian crisis in Somalia brought on by drought and conflict. Michael Keating is the Secretary General's Special Representative for Somalia and head of the UN Assistance in Somalia.
Somalia is experiencing a moment of both tragedy and hope. Tragedy because a drought-induced humanitarian crisis is now engulfing the country with imminent risk of famine. Hope because the recent electoral process has created momentum for fresh political engagement among Somalis. The announcement 48 hours ago of the cabinet, including six women, is another important step forward. Mr. President, over 6 million Somalis, half the total population, are now in need of assistance. Nearly 3 million, mainly women and children, require immediate life-saving support, including growing numbers of displaced people living in miserable conditions. Somalis, including politicians, business people, civil society, and members of the diaspora, are taking responsibility for drought response. This distinguishes Somalia from other countries facing humanitarian catastrophe. President Farmajo has declared a national disaster within days of taking office. He is using all available platforms to mobilize national and international support. Access remains a challenge, including in al-Shabaab-controlled areas. But compared to 2011, when 260,000 people died, the scope for responding to the crisis is greater.
Keating explained how the response differs from 2011 and what more needs to be done.
Cell phone coverage and money transfer options have expanded. Data on needs and assessment have improved. Controls on resources and partner vetting is stronger, and operational capacities have grown. Humanitarian partners are scaling up the response, including through private sector and cash programming in affected areas. More people are now being reached with food aid, nutritional support, healthcare services, and access to safe water. But much more is needed. The most urgent challenges include funding for immediate life-saving action, in particular for the cholera response, which has now affected 11 of the 18 regions. Treatment centers and units are being opened throughout the country, but the disease continues to spread. Rapid scale-up of treatment and preventive measures are urgently needed before the rains, which will only further exacerbate the problem. The Famine Prevention Operational Plan seeks $825 million US dollars to reach 5.5 million people by June. The plan is currently 32% funded. Funding and cash flow constraints prevented a significant increase in response activities at the beginning of the year. More resources are needed by the end of March to enable partners to reach affected people before it is too late.
The UN Special Representative said the recent presidential election in Somalia has wide-ranging positive effects.
The elation that greeted President Farmajo on February the 8th transcended clan and regional lines. The outcome of the process has generated widespread goodwill. As Prime Minister Haile Mariam of Ethiopia said, Somalis have made history and set a great example to countries emerging from conflict. The complexity and imperfections of the electoral process have not diminished expectation that there must be one person, one vote in 2020. Preparations must begin now to establish the necessary legal and administrative framework to lay the groundwork for inclusive elections and to permit women to compete on equal terms to men.
However, Keating said unless Somalia can attract serious investment and generate domestic revenues, state building will remain only an aspiration. He added the country would remain vulnerable to weather-related shocks. Somali President Farmajo also expressed the Security Council by video link.
The progress made in Somalia is making can be a difficult to meet the challenge of drought and humanitarian crisis, both in our country and within the region. But we must not forget it and give way to simply doom and gloom. We in Somalia strongly believe that socioeconomic and political gain must go hand in hand with good governance to achieve sustainable development for all our people.
The Somali president pledged to defeat al-Shabaab terrorist groups, but he said the only way to truly ensure Somalia's security is to rebuild the national army. Also today, the Security Council voted to extend the mandate of the UN assistance mission in Somalia until June.
A new climate study from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology predicts a hotter planet over the course of the 21st century will mean increased drought in sub-Saharan Africa. That will lead to a dramatic reduction in the production of maize, the continent's most important staple crop. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Amy Dale, the study's lead author. Dale is an environmental engineering and public policy expert with MIT's Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences.
We had a couple goals in mind when we did this. One of them was just to sort of understand the what we would call the median change, sort of what is the most likely outcome under climate change for maize production. But we were also really interested in the uncertainty in those predictions because we have many global models of changes in climate in the future, and each of those models makes a slightly different prediction. And so we wanted to sort of paint a map of Africa in the future and where we might be able to make some solid decisions now and where we might also still have a lot of uncertainty that needs to get resolved to help us make decisions.
What kind of decisions do you want to make?
Infrastructure and investment planning in the future under climate change, thinking about things like expansion of irrigation, perhaps irrigation infrastructure, hydropower development, infrastructure and investment planning under climate change, these kinds of questions that we have about how we can ensure a food secure future and also help Africa meet its many needs going forward over the next many decades.
When you talk about climate change, you're talking about heating up of the climate and also the amount of rainfall, correct? I mean, isn't that what's related to maize production?
Yes, we have under climate change global increases in temperature. We also have shifts in precipitation or rainfall patterns. In some cases, those effects will be in the same direction in terms of how they impact maize production. In some cases, they may have opposite effects. And so we'll see regional trends across the continent, mostly negative impacts on maize production. But in some small regions throughout Africa, we actually do see the opposite of potential increases in maize production as well.
Now, maize production is dependent upon rainfall. And if there's a drought, which I assume that your climate model also predicts, that means less corn, right?
That's exactly right. In Africa, most of the maize production across the continent is rain-fed. So there isn't a lot of reliance on irrigation. What this means is that as we see changes in precipitation, along with increases in temperature, there isn't perhaps as much resilience to those rainfall changes as we might see in a region with a lot of irrigation. So it makes it quite sensitive to changes in climate. So the combination can be quite bad.
What was the aspect of the study that fascinated you the most? In terms of your own area of comfort and expertise, did you have any oh wow moments during this study?
I was surprised by how large some of these changes are anticipated to be in particular regions of Africa. I mean, we have countries like Zambia and South Africa where we're anticipating losses of maize production of 20% or larger median. And that's quite severe. We have particular grid cells within the model. These are sort of subregions that we average over to get national estimates or regional estimates, where we're seeing greater than 50% declines in the maize production. So this is really quite serious.
This is directly relevant to food scarcity and food security. All this is really important for how Africans eat.
Yes. I mean, maize is the most calorically important crop in sub-Saharan Africa. And so this has a direct implication for these populations, a large fraction of which rely on subsistence farming. So we're talking about a region of the world that has almost a quarter of the world's malnourished population. And so this is a very serious problem for food security going forward.
That was environmental engineering and policy expert Amy Dale of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
After 5 years of drought, Angola is now getting too much rain. AFP reports floods have killed at least 11 people and left thousands homeless in northwestern Luanda province. At least 700 homes have been destroyed. The heavy rains began Tuesday. Officials warn that reservoirs on the outskirts of Luanda are near capacity and could overflow soon, and the soil is saturated and cannot absorb any more water. Many roads are underwater, especially in rural areas. A lot of people are traveling by canoes provided by emergency services.
A human rights organization says armed groups in Central African Republic have occupied, looted, and damaged hundreds of schools, preventing thousands of children from getting an education. VOA's Jody Kapua has the story.
A new Human Rights Watch report entitled No Class says Seleka rebels, anti-Balaka militias, and even UN peacekeeping troops have used school buildings as barracks or bases. Louis Mudge is an Africa researcher for the group.
Approximately 20% of the schools right now in the CAR are not functioning. And the reasons given for most of those schools not functioning have to do with the conflict, whether that be schools that were damaged by fighters' occupation, schools that were attacked, or students and teachers who are just afraid to go to school due to the proximity of fighters nearby.
Mudge explains why armed groups prefer occupying schools.
In many, many towns and villages across the country, schools are the best buildings. They have concrete floors. They have good metal roofs. The walls are usually pretty solid. So for a rebel group that came into town, this makes perfect sense as a place to take over. What's more is that schools, most of the time, are based along the principal road, which gives them access to stopping traffic. So it's a natural place for these rebel groups to set up a road barrier.
Fighters often burn school books and furniture to cook their meals. Mudge says that children have lost years of education in many parts of CAR because armed groups fail to treat schools as places of learning and sanctuaries for children.
In some of the towns we found, this problem has been going on since the Seleka took over. So that was in Bangui, March of 2013, but in other parts of the country, this was in late 2012. The Seleka began their offensive in late 2012.
The mostly Christian and animist anti-Balaka militias were formed to wage revenge attacks against the mostly Muslim Seleka rebels. Mudge says school occupations in CAR could increase soon.
What we found is that a lot of these occupations are seasonal. Right now, the dry season is coming to a close in the Central African Republic, and the rains are going to start. And what we were told pretty openly by fighters was that, yeah, once the rain starts, we'll move back into the school because we don't want to get wet.
The government signed the Safe Schools Declaration in mid-2015, committing itself to protecting schools. The UN mission then began clearing schools that were occupied. But last year, its own forces were found inside schools.
We were very surprised to find that. This is in direct violation of the Safe Schools Declaration that was signed by the national government, but also in violation of a directive that was issued by MINUSCA, the peacekeeping mission, in late 2015 on this issue. The directive is very, very clear. It says, under no circumstances are soldiers from the UN mission to occupy schools.
Mudge says, however, when informed of what some peacekeeping troops were doing, the UN took immediate action to end it. He says, unless MINUSCA prevents armed groups from occupying schools, there may be a lost generation of students, those who have missed years of education and are not able to recover. Not much help is expected from CAR's year-old government. It has very little power outside the capital, Bangui, where most of the violence and fighting is taking place. The government is struggling to maintain order and relies heavily on international assistance. The Human Rights Watch report has been released prior to the second International Safe Schools Conference. It's being held in Buenos Aires, March 28th and 29th. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
20 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. At least 10 Egyptian soldiers and 15 militants are reported dead in the central Sinai after police raided a hideout today. An army spokesman says the soldiers were killed by roadside bombs as their vehicles tried to chase the militants. He says 7 militants have been arrested. Egypt is fighting an insurgency in northern Sinai for many years, mostly against an affiliate of the Islamic State. Reports say Egyptian troops have destroyed large amounts of explosives in the raid and seized weapons, ammunition, and equipment. In related news, Reuters quotes the Egyptian Interior Ministry as saying 2 policemen and an officer and a conscript were later killed in fighting near a police station in Arish, the capital of North Sinai province, the Interior Ministry said in a statement. The Associated Press says even though the fighting is hundreds of kilometers from the Red Sea tourist destinations, tourism has sharply declined due to fear of terrorist attacks. In October 2015, a bomb caused a Russian airliner full of tourists to crash. All 224 people on board were killed.
With Zimbabwe's soaring unemployment rate, some youth in the capital, Harare, have created their own jobs. They're fixing the many potholes in the city roads. Reporter Kudzana Vashi has this report.
Unemployed youths solicit tips from motorists after a day fixing potholes. Motorist Nyson Ngoma says it's a sad sight.
It is a very, very sorry scene, because if you look at the number of the youth that will be doing this, like it's a big number. Like most of the scenes that you see these youth filling up the potholes, they'd be like 5, 6, 7 youths at one position. And this is the working class. They should be working.
Ngoma says the city council is doing a poor job of repairing the city's streets.
They are neglecting their duties. Council is definitely neglecting their duties. The service delivery is poor, very, very poor. As of late, the tarred roads are a very sorry state. Like there is less tar on the roads than there are potholes. There is not even any tar at all. This is the worst situation Zimbabwe has ever been in, also considering the rains.
Munyara Zichagombera found himself out of a job after an injury at work last year. He now repairs roads in a bid to make ends meet.
Things are hard, my brother. There is no money. We will be seeing the soil on the roadsides with no one fixing the potholes. We end up coming to work and collecting 10 cents from motorists.
Chagombera says they do not make much for a day's work. He splits $8 with a co-worker. The city council is against Chagombera and others fixing roads. Spokesperson Michael Chideme explains.
Because they are not road engineers, they don't know anything about road maintenance. All they are doing is damaging the roads and damaging people's vehicles. That job resides with the city of Harare, so that's our work. Our message to the public is they should stop paying them. Because paying them, or continuously paying them, is continuously encouraging them to damage their roads.
Meanwhile, Ngoma says some of the youths fixing roads are not doing a good job.
But also these people who are filling up the potholes, they are quite lazy, very, very lazy. They do not fill up all the potholes. They select the potholes they want to fill up and then start hassling people. They should fill up like the whole neighborhood, or select an area, the whole area, to fill up and then start collecting revenue.
Experts concur with the city council that the youth fixing roads may damage them to some extent. But motorists and residents say council is not doing its mandated job of road repairs. And they say the work done by the young workers keeps them from meandering to avoid potholes when driving. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
The World Health Organization is warning the battle to wipe out the global tuberculosis epidemic will not be won unless stigma, discrimination, and marginalization of TB patients is brought to an end. The WHO issued the warning in advance of World TB Day tomorrow. From Geneva, Alicia Schlein reports on the launch of new WHO ethics guidance for TB treatment.
Progress is being made toward achieving the UN Sustainable Development Goal of ending the global TB epidemic by 2030. The World Health Organization reports 49 million lives have been saved since 2000, but much remains to be done. Data from 2015 show more than 10.4 million people fell ill and 1.8 million died of tuberculosis, with most cases and fatalities occurring in developing countries. The World Health Organization says stigma and discrimination against TB patients hamper efforts to wipe out this deadly disease. WHO Global TB Program Medical Officer Ernesto Jaramillo says vulnerable people such as migrants, prisoners, ethnic minorities, marginalized women and children are most likely to suffer abuse, neglect, and rejection. He says this prevents them from seeking treatment for tuberculosis.
Having new tools for diagnosis and treatment of TB is not sufficient if there are not clear standards to ensure that vulnerable people can have access in a matter of priority to these tools in a way that the strategy, the NTB strategy, can really serve the interest not only of individuals, but also the interest of public health in general.
WHO Global TB Program Director Mario Raviglione tells VOA no country, rich or poor, is immune from getting tuberculosis. He warns marginalizing patients with TB is dangerous.
You cannot eliminate a disease like TB, you know, thinking that you build walls or you isolate your country. TB is an airborne disease, travels by air. So you have a Boeing 747 that leaves, you know, Malawi tonight and it comes to Switzerland tomorrow morning, and there you go. So it has to be faced from a global perspective.
New WHO ethical guidance includes actions to overcome barriers of stigma, discrimination, and marginalization of people with tuberculosis. The agency says protecting the human rights of all those affected will save many lives and will make it possible to end this global scourge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And Our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.